Gene, that was, I can't remember his last name. Sure, he's long since dead, but no, he wasn't the engineer. I forget who it was that actually came up with the first plan for this thing. And we, a bunch of people worked on it, you know, and came up with the ideas. We sat down, you know, and drew up a little sketch and said, well, okay, we got to bring these prisoners in. And the first thing we want to do is de-louse the clowns, you know.
Okay.
So we want to have the medical facilities right near the front of the building. So the first thing they have to do, we'll come in there and we'll, you know, run through a shower and all that good stuff. And then right after that, we're going to sit them down and yeah, they got to be checked out by a doctor and then a nurse.
Because I bet a lot of them are coming in shot up or something.
Not that so much, but God knows what diseases they might be carrying with them.
Okay.
And or suffering from something, or they needed certain medication, whatever. And it wouldn't do you much good if they died the first day they were there. You never get a chance to interrogate them.
Okay.
So we figured that one of the first things we needed to do with them when they came in was to have them checked out by a medical staff and cleaned up. So that's why the medical office was right inside the main gate.
Vietnamese medic, doctor.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We couldn't
afford to have a doctor.
We had one doctor for the whole CIA station and a couple of medics.
Okay.
And we weren't about to put doctors in there, our own doctors in there. And in most places it was just a medic. And what they would do when they had prisoners coming in, they would get a local doctor or something, an army doctor would come out. Okay. And for that particular day or whatever, he would check the prisoners. And so that was of necessity. We wanted it close to where the cell block was, so we could run them right through, you know, run them in.
Are you going to draw me a diagram today? Is that what you're planning for?
Yeah, I can remember. I've got the, like I say, all right, here we go. And if I call medical staff, was, like I say, the first thing inside the main gate over here was usually there's officers in here, and they also had a weapons room, I think. So, cells were down here. And back in this corner was the kitchen, usually.
Okay.
Cells were here, both sides.
So there's a corridor going down the
down the middle of the cell.
You got doors in it periodically or anything like that, like in a police station, like a jail or something.
Sure, there's cells, individual cells, and they got a door and with a panel at the bottom. We can slip the food in and slide at the top where you can look in and see what the guy's doing and close.
Can you see all the way down though? I mean,
you walk right down the middle, and there's cells on both sides.
Okay, but there's no doors down that corridor.
No.
Oh, okay.
One empty corridor all the way.
Okay.
All the way down.
That's all.
And then down there we had the kitchen and a dining area for the staff, down this corner here.
Okay.
And then the interrogation rooms. I guess the interrogation rooms are down here too. Interrogation rooms were here, and up here was the where the reports writers and the files and all that stuff was kept on the
special branch guys.
So they come out and then the chief would have an office usually maybe up here or down this corner, wherever he wanted.
Okay.
But the way we set it up, I think your office was right in here. And then after the medical in this corner and the showers and all, then there was a debriefing room here where they got the basic information from the guy.
Okay.
You know, like personal history statement type thing.
Okay, biographical stuff. Yeah. Okay.
And then he was assigned to a cell, and when he was taken, given his uniform, prison uniform, was taken down and stuck in a cell. And then the interrogators and these editorial, the clerical staff and all had their offices over here. And this is where they would write the reports and all. This is where the interrogation rooms were down here.
Okay.
As I recall.
Anybody sleep in these places?
Say, this is wrong, you got it ass backwards, but I'm just
kidding. Yeah, right. Well, I get that idea. And then you got your water tower.
Water tower here, and on top of the water tower you had a guard post up there.
And you got your other stuff on this.
Yep.
These guys on there.
Guard post in this corner.
Okay.
And you had gates here, you could swing shut, and they were usually kept open. Every time I went to these damn things, the gates were wide open.
Okay.
I guess at night they closed, and I hope they did. I never went out to them at night.
Well, I bet you...
Most of them go on the outskirts of town. You didn't want to go visit those places at night.
There's nobody living there, right? I mean, that's not a barracks or nothing like that. People just got to rotate.
The guards live there.
The guards do live there.
The guards live there, absolutely. Yes. The ones that weren't on duty were sleeping there. We had some quarters for them.
So how many...
They were along here, too.
How many Vietnamese does it take to run the place?
God. Guard force, I guess, consisted of about maybe 12 or 14 guys, somewhere in that vicinity.
And are they military? Are they orphans?
They were military, I think, or they were, I guess it varied.
Or military police or something?
I think they came, they might have been police. A special, not special branch, but CIO, I don't know. Okay. People, they might have been. I don't remember what the hell they were. They were Vietnamese, I know that. And they were, some of them were carrying around, they had given them these goddamn M1 rifles. And they were heavier than, they weighed more than the Vietnamese guards that they could pick them up. And some of them, they really had a good store of weapons. A couple of BARs and stuff. And again, the BARs took two Vietnamese to pick it up and carry it.
Is that what they got on top of the water tower as a BAR? Or they had a regular 50 caliber machine gun?
They were usually up there with a carbine or something like that.
Okay.
If they ever came under attack, then they'd break out all the heavy weapons that they had, but they had some machine guns and BARs.
So are they made out of concrete? Is it cement? Concrete?
Yes.
What do they? How do they build them in the Delta when they must sink right in the ground?
No. Build them on a piece of land. It's, you're going to have a delta. It's not all water.
No,
you've got a lot of solid ground. You've got to find a plot of ground that you can build on.
So that's what you need the engineer for, is to find it. So you find it.
Every place was different. We build them in the mountains. We build them in the delta. And you build them on the coast and you whatever. And you have to, engineer, go out and check out the spot. You say, we can't build it here. Okay, we find another spot. And once they,
is it usually near the provincial capital? Is it in like a...
Oh, always.
You're always near the provincial...
Oh, sure, because that's where our guys were stationed, in the province.
Okay.
Capital of the province.
But on a suitable piece of grounds, but they're not trying to build them on top of a hill or something like that?
No.
Of thing like that?
Wherever they could find ground, the province chief would let them have.
Or sell to them.
Or sell it to them, whatever. I don't know. That was their problem, how the Vietnamese worked it out. All I knew is that it was up to our guys. Once the priority was established within the region, it was up to our guys within the provinces. Okay, your top priority, you got to go out. You go talk to the province chief along with your CIO counterpart.
Yeah, that's not your job.
My job was I went around to help them on some of that. Because in addition to training the staffs when they finally get built, once I got into it all from the graph, I'm going out with each one of them and helping them to locate a spot, giving them ideas about where they might get the property, telling them, because once I'd worked in a couple of provinces with these guys, I'd be able to go and tell another guy, and he's just now getting off the ground. What do I do first?
Okay.
I say, okay, here's what worked in such province, here's what worked in the other
province.
You're
talking about the province officer.
Our guy.
Yeah, all right.
Because, they never had any training in any of this either. All of a sudden, the guy says, build a pick and staff it. He says, what do I do first, right?
Okay.
And he's never done it before.
Okay.
It's like, build me an airplane. Well, what do I do first? Get somebody who built one to come and tell you.
Okay.
So that was part of my job, to travel around to each place. And then in one place I'd go in, the construction would be halfway done. Another place I'd go in, they were just trying to find a piece of land. Another place, the next province I'd go to.
So they're all going up.
They were different stages.
They're all going up simultaneously, pretty basically, and they're all.
Not really simultaneously, but they were.
Yeah, in some.
According to our priorities, once we said, okay, these six are supposed to be built now, and we had deadlines for them.
Okay.
Deadline for finding the land, deadline for getting a contractor, deadline for starting the construction, the deadline for recruiting your staff, and then the deadline for when we were going to start training them, and so on down the line. And it got to be, we had, I don't know how many provinces there were there, 30-some, 40?
44, yeah.
And so eventually we were going to build one in every one. So It's a big undertaking. I mean, and when they were in, all the way from the time we started until the time I left, they were in various stages of development in each province.
So was Tucker going to each of the provinces too?
Tucker didn't go.
He went.
I went.
Tucker stayed back in Saigon and mm-hmm. said, "How you doing?"
Well, Tucker had a lot of things to do in Saigon. He had picks, but you know, he had everything of country. He didn't just have picks. He gave the picks. That's what I was supposed to do for him.
Okay.
And other people were supposed to do other things. I mean, he ran the whole show.
But that's unusual for a guy to be doing that many things, isn't it? I mean, most guys are either just PM or other guys are police because they're two sides.
All of our stuff was liaison, basically.
Okay.
That Tucker ran. He ran all liaison operations.
Oh, okay.
And that included special branch, included the CIO,
okay.
And any other liaison we had.
Okay.
He didn't get involved. He wasn't running the CT teams and the PAT teams. That was being run by another group.
Okay.
But anything to do with liaison was under Tucker.
Okay.
But he had the Hammett and Bowman program, all different programs. Our guy in the province was running four or five different programs at the same time.
Yeah, okay.
Right? And one of those things was a pick.
Okay. And is he the PIC advisor then, or is somebody else hired specifically to be an advisor to the PIC?
I was the PIC man.
For each one of them? Or what about...
Oh, the guy in the province was it. Oh, yeah, okay. We didn't give him an extra man to run the PICs for.
Oh, okay, that's what I was going to ask you.
That's why a lot of them went through happy about it. Of all the other problems they had, here they had to start to take care of these PICs too, and I don't blame them.
Okay.
They had plenty to keep them busy, and now we gave them one more thing.
Okay.
To keep them busy.
Okay.
Now, my job was to help them any way I could at any time, and they wanted me up there or down there or wherever at any time, they could call and say, "Hey,
okay,
we want Picadoon to come by and next swing this way, stop in." And I just went around anyway, because even if they were running,
yeah,
if I was going to a particular area, say that I was going down to the Mito area,
yeah,
I would check in with the chief of the region there.
Yeah.
I'd first tell him, so I'm quick coming, and, I didn't have to ask him. If I could go, Tucker said, "That's where where do you want to go this week?" And I'd tell him what I planned, and he'd read this, and that's where I'd go. But I would check in with the regional guy,
okay,
if he had any place that he wanted me to go while I was in the area that I hadn't planned to go, that maybe he knew about some problem that we didn't know about. And so he said,
"Okay.
And while you're here, how about stopping over and man, whatever, and talking to so-and-so, because he's got a problem, and we don't know for sure how to handle it."
Okay.
And so I'd stop in, and if I knew how to handle it, fine. If I didn't know how to handle it, I'd say, "Well, I'll get back to Tucker, and we'll get back at you."
How much did it cost to build a PIC?
I'd say, God, let me see, I think about $30,000. I'm worried about sending.
So
the Army came in with their plan, it was going to cost over $1,000, but it was, I'm not sure, maybe it wasn't that much, maybe it was $60,000, but it was a lot more than ours.
Then we had
what we called nitpicks.
Okay.
We didn't really call them. They were called demi-picks or semi-picks or something like that.
Okay.
But I called them nitpicks.
Okay.
They were smaller versions of the bigger, the ordinary pick. And some provinces were stupid to have anything real. There's no reason why Natron, with all the people around there, they needed a good size pick. You could hold whatever number of prisoners, say 60 or whatever it was. Or 40. But you get into some of these provinces where there wasn't much going on in the first place, it'd be sort of stupid to build a great big, we finally came to that conclusion. Not in the beginning, but after a while we started thinking, "Hey, it's ridiculous, these guys." And the guys in the province told us, they said, "You don't want to build something that big down here, you never fill it."
Okay.
And so we said, "Okay, we just modify the building and make it smaller, and we call them Netflix." I call them. Other people got them. They were called demi picks or half picks. I don't know.
So the big ones hold 60, and the smaller ones hold half.
Oh, I can't remember how many they held. I don't think they held 60. I don't think any of them. Maybe 30 would have been better. Maybe 30 or 40 prisoners.
30 cells or 30 prisoners?
Oh, we only put one prisoner to a cell. That's what we wanted. That's what they were supposed to do.
Is isolating the guys part of the deal?
Oh yeah, when I'm sitting there talking to each other,
okay,
there's no way they could.
Okay.
They were completely isolated. They were in their cell. They didn't see the other prisoners ever. They didn't get time to go and walk around in the yard like you do in a prison here.
Okay.
They sat in their cell, and when they went being interrogated, they were in their cell. And once they were finished with the interrogation, they went Then they were sent to the local jail or wherever, and then they kept them in. Matter of fact, they were treated better in the picks than they were. Hell, a lot better than they were in some of the local jails. I went in some.
Did you have anything to do with the local jails?
No, but I went into a couple of them.
Did anybody?
Just to look at them, yeah. And see how.
Was anybody advising the regular jails?
I don't think so. If any, it would have been a special branch people that would have been.
What about public safety people?
Oh, yeah, no, sure they were. Yeah, but no CIA guys.
Okay.
So, public safety, yeah, under the AID.
They advise the regular jails?
Well, yeah, that's what their job was. They work with the police. They advise them in traffic control, all sorts of things, you know, whatever, okay. Whatever they needed. Okay. That was their job.
So there's always a regular jail in a big province town, aside from the...
Like there is here in this country.
Okay, all right.
You get arrested for stealing rice, they throw you in jail.
Did they have to build them, too?
We didn't. They were already there.
They were already there. Are they remnants of the French days or something like that?
Back to those days, I guess. They were big pens. I mean, they had 60, 70 people in a room that shouldn't have held more than about 10. But that's what they had, and that's the way they didn't care. It was criminal to them. If you're a criminal, you suffer. If you don't like it, too bad. You don't be a criminal.
And then I suppose on top of all that, there's got to be military. Did they have any?
Oh yeah, well, that's what these guys. When I said they went to jail, they didn't go to the local lockup.
Yeah.
When they left our place, they went turned back over to the military.
Okay.
Where they were put in military POW camps or whatever they called them.
Oh okay.
And, or taken out and shot. For all I know, I don't know what they did with them, but they were given back.
Okay.
For that part of it, I never got involved in. I never cared.
Okay, but I'm just trying to differentiate between a jail for civilians and a jail for
Viet Cong. Oh yeah, they were not put in with the regular common crooks, murderers, thieves, all that.
How did their what were their jails like?
I never saw any.
Never saw any. Okay.
Say their jails might have been 6 feet under, for all I know.
Okay. Okay.
Good question. I've never heard about whatever happened to all the prisoners, the Viet Cong prisoners that was there when the North Vietnamese finally won that war. Were there any prisoners to be released?
Jeez.
Or were they all dead?
I'll have to find out.
There was a lot captured.
Because people got
to... I just wonder whatever happened to them.
People got to go from the pick somewhere. Who knows?
Well, I'm sure they went to a prison somewhere, a prison camp. My question is, when the North Vietnamese finally won the war, did they find any of their own buddies there still alive, or were they all dead?
Well, I know when in Japan, when the Americans were going to invade Japan, they had a standing order to kill all American POWs rather than turn them over. But then they dropped the bomb, so they never nobody ever got killed.
Yeah, except for the bomb.
Yeah.
But,
they were.
I think my only concern was the.
So you didn't have any concern with afterwards
finding a place to build one. Yeah. Building it, staffing it, getting some prisoners into it, getting some intelligence out of it.
Yeah.
And then just keep on going. But what happened to the prisoners after the FDI? No concern of mine. I was worried about building another pick somewhere.
Okay. So you
And I never really saw too many of the intelligence reports that came out of it.
Okay. So you're traveling all over the place. You travel by Air America?
Scare America. It took me everywhere I went.
Did you ever get to know any of the pilots?
Yeah, a lot of them. For the most part, pretty good group of guys.
Yeah. Can you...
Crazy.
You keep in touch with anybody who might consider talking with you?
There was one guy that was local from the Washington area, and I happened to have been good friends with his in-law, his brother-in-law, and I don't even know where he is. I think he's still over there flying to somebody.
Okay.
But, I left that area. Got to go out to Thailand, they still flew me.
But they're in the More Air America. That was disbanded in 76 or 70.
Well, I was in Thailand right after I left Vietnam, and Air America was still going strong.
Yeah.
But,
now they call it Southern Air Transport.
Well, Southern Air Transport existed then, too.
Yeah.
Southern Air has been around a long time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're going all over the place, and you're meeting everybody, huh? So you get to meet every guy in every province, and every province you go to.
Yep. Got to know their cooks, their guards. Used to go out. One of the things that a lot of them liked when I came, because I liked to go out to the range any chance I could.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the guards at some of these places never got a chance to go out and practice.
Yeah.
But when I came to town, all I would do was they'd be able to go, because you know, when I had some free time, that's why I talked with the guy about what was going on in his pick and what he needed and what have you, then I could write, usually take the guard thing and write and shoot a little bit.
Okay.
But so I hit them all. And
so did you meet Ray Valentine while you were there?
I knew Ray before that.
Yeah, but did you build a pick for him?
We had, I don't think we ever got one finished in his province. I went up and visited his province and talked to him about it. We went around and looked at possible sites, but his wasn't a high priority. Well, there's a lot of fighting going on there. They were taking a lot of prisoners.
Yeah.
That's one of the problems. And the military was getting most of them. When they got them, they were taking them, and they were, you know, by the time they would be turned over to anybody else,
yeah,
there wouldn't have been much intelligence left that we could have gotten out of them anyway.
Okay.
But, no, I visited there and went to the state of Ray's house. And that was just in the beginning stages of finding a spot. I can't remember whether Ray had found the spot or not, or whether he was having a problem. Some of them had a problem getting the spot, because the province chiefs were on me, didn't like them, or whatever, or for the wrong reasons, they wanted money on their table or something.
Okay.
And some places just wasn't any land that they could take.
Okay.
And that the province chief was willing to take from somebody and give to them.
Yeah.
So that held back some of them. But no, I was in every province there in the country except two.
Do you remember which two?
If I could look at a map, I could. Both of them were near the, they were in, one was in 3 Corps, one was in 4 Corps, whatever region they were. One was in the Mito, one was in the Benoit. They're both near the Laos and, Cambodian border.
Okay.
And they were very small, provinces, and they were kind of bottomless priority list. Red thought I should go. He said, I should go. You'd be probably the only American ever been in every province in this country. And I was only a couple of weeks away from going home at the time. And I said, no, thank you. I don't think I want to go fly anywhere. I don't have to fly.
Okay.
This close to going home. So I missed those two. But I was in every other province. And worked with our guy in each province. See, in a couple of these provinces, too, we didn't have any. There was a couple of provinces we didn't have anybody actually living there. At the time, we had a guy that would cover two provinces, and he had a house there, a place he could sleep.
Yep.
You know, it could have been with the other guy who was on the other side of the hall who had a house there,
okay.
Or it could have been with a MacBee guy or something. And so they would cover two provinces from one place.
Okay.
That was the case for these two provinces.
Okay. And sometimes there's more than one PM guy, right? I mean, sometimes there's one guy for revolutionary development and one guy for census grievance and all that kind of stuff.
Towards the end of my tour there, when I got ready to leave, we were having, like in the Chong, there was a whole crew of people. I mean, it was...
Yeah, well, that's a big, big place.
Yeah, and Da Nang, too. But, and in some of the other places, now in the regional headquarters, they'd have more than one guy sometimes.
Yeah.
And he'd have a secretary and an admin guy working with him, and maybe another... ops type that could be his troubleshooter and travel around the region for him when he couldn't.
Yeah.
But usually in the province,
just like a deputy,
yeah.
Or something.
Yeah. But
like
usually
that.
In the province, it was just one guy.
He'd be handling both liaison and CT teams.
No. One guy handling liaison, one guy handling CT.
Yeah. Okay.
But I'm talking to you. I'm not talking about the CT side and the fat team.
Okay.
They're two different shots.
Because you don't have anything to do with them.
Oh, yeah. A lot to do with them, but I mean, not to do with picks,
okay.
Except that whereas they could help us, and they could, like in the one case where we had the CT team go out and capture some people that we had been pinpointed by one of our operations,
okay.
And interrogated them, and then gave the information back to the CT team, so they went back out and got more people.
One of the things about Phoenix is that they have these blacklists that they're supposed to write up. But from what I understand, those kind of things were in existence before Phoenix. Isn't it just the same thing as you get intelligence from a guy and he says, yeah, well, there's, you know, Trang Van Trang is the deputy chief, and so you put his name down, and that's like a list.
Right?
Yeah, right, that's like a...
You know, they weren't told, but hey, I tell you, you know, Oh, checking in the CTs. These guys were small groups, you know, the CT teams.
Tell me, yeah.
They were heavily armed, but they were a small group. The PAC teams were, I think, 30, 40 right. guys. And the CT teams were like 10.
Yeah.
And they're out there on their own, operating in the jungle, in BC-controlled areas a lot of times, armed to the teeth, but small groups. And what kind of guys...
Led by SEALs or Marines or Special Forces guys.
What kind of guys are you going to get to do this? You're not going to get your just average Joe off the street who says, oh, yeah, I'd love to. Give me some machine gun. I'd love to live in the jungle, you know, with out amongst 6,000 Viet Cong, me and my nine buddies. You know, I'd love to do that. You get criminals and everything else. Anything to get the hell out of jail. You know, all sorts of strange people. But yeah, you get out there on the road, who's going to control them?
Yeah.
Well, they decide they want to kill somebody instead of kidnap them and bring them back.
Yeah.
You know, you're not with them. And you have no control, you have no knowledge for sure what they're doing out there.
Any of them, any of the CIA guys who are on the paramilitary side, any of them going out with the CT teams?
Some did.
They were supposed to, but they did, huh?
Oh, sure. A bunch of young guys. Hell, they had a little excitement. Why not?
Okay.
But, there's a lot of people doing a lot of things that they weren't supposed to be doing as far as, you know, for their own health, your own safety. You're not supposed to do this, you're not supposed to do that.
Yeah, don't go here after nightfall. Don't go to that
thing. Anyway, yeah. But some guys, you tell them not to do it.
Do what you're going to do.
Do it.
Why can't I do this?
Why can't I eat that apple? I'm going to go taste it.
Okay. Right. The forbidden fruit. Right. Okay.
But for the most part, they were smart enough to stay. I mean, hell, yeah, every once in a while, the town would be attacked anyway.
So you couldn't really avoid too much trouble.
Why would you go out looking for it when you know it's going to come and find you sometime anyway? You might as well stay home where it was a little bit safe and be prepared for it when it came.
Yeah.
But basically, there were two guys in every province.
Okay, most of the guys leading the CT teams are like my friend there who's a SEAL. It's SEALs or military guys that are actually the American advisor on the CT teams. Special Forces kind of guys.
We didn't have any guys like that. The advisors to the CT teams were our guys.
They were? Okay. Yeah. Civilians?
Civilians.
Okay.
But they didn't go out on patrol with these guys. And the PAT teams, the same thing. They were, well, in each province, you had two guys. One worked liaison and the other worked with the guerrilla warfare guys. And yeah, they work very closely with each other in some provinces. Some provinces didn't even talk to each other.
Later on, what happens is that when the CT teams become PRUs, Provincial Reconnaissance Units, every PM guy, paramilitary guy in the station has like a Navy SEAL or a Special Forces guy who's assigned to him to run his PRU team.
Oh, yeah, okay, fine. That was after I was talking.
Okay, that's after you got
it.
Yeah, they did.
They always had somebody like that who was trained.
Because these guys are... Yeah, they trained for a year how to eat snakes and do all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
And in the beginning, there just wasn't enough people to go around in the first place. The Special Forces guys we had and the SEALs, they were on other assignments. They weren't going out with just these teams.
They do those stuff.
They had other.
They were on their own,
right? And the CTs were on their own.
Okay.
But I think that probably what happened is when they came up and they formed this program and all, they said, we want guys going out with them. You don't want them running around there deciding who they're going to kill and who they're not by themselves. We want somebody with them that can control them.
Okay.
And we're not going to send our guys out there because they weren't going to, you know, all trained and had training in that, but not like these, not like the SEALs and the Special Forces. Let them go out. These are the guys that were trained to do this stuff.
So you want to tell me a little bit about Harry Monk or not? What he was doing?
Harry worked on that side of the hall with the paramilitary.
In a particular province?
Well, you know, he did, yeah, he was in, I think, Benzin province.
Okay.
One of the problems there. But, hey, you know, I can't tell you about Harry Monk. I don't want Harry Monk's payment every anything I said about him. Because, you know, Harry Monk, they say, hey, wait a minute, John, I'm retired to co-work. Nobody knows I ever worked with the CIA. You know, I don't want to know. I got a nice job here with a bank, and they're going to fire my ass if they find out I lied to them or whatever. So, I don't want to talk about it. Hey, well, you talk to Harry Monk. You call him. See if he wants to talk to you. But don't say anything about him. Put his name in there for anything I said about him.
Understood.
You know, if he was here, I'd ask him, and if he said yes, I'd put you in touch with him and you could talk to him, but you know, I can't speak for him.
That guy, Ian Teague, was a PM guy in the province just north of Beijing.
Well, he was known.
He was an Aussie, and they had, because I interviewed that guy, Donovan, and he told me all about Ian Teague. I could do some other one. Yeah, sure.
I wouldn't miss any. Aussie was great. I'm done with this. They were a good bunch. And I'm talking about the ones who worked for us.
Yeah.
The combat troops there, they were some of the best.
Yeah, they got a reputation for being the good soldiers. My father was in a... No, Tensorano? No. He's the one that was the head of the National Police Field Force.
I remember when they set that up. But no, I wasn't involved in that. I knew it existed in all the other units, I guess. One of the coups was coming, or attempted coups. And we flew into Way, and I had this guy with me who was a special branch police major. And he was taking a tour with me. We were checking out a lot of the interrogation center. He was just checking on how the special branch cops were doing and any problems they had and this sort of thing. He was like a personnel officer, basically.
Oh, you never told me how many special branch guys there would be at a pit. You told me how many guards, but you didn't tell me how many.
Oh, there'd be maybe six or seven interrogators, there'd be the chief and the deputy, and maybe that was it. I don't know, a couple others.
And then guards, but the guards don't do the record keeping, right?
No, they had analysts. I guess they call them analysts. They were civilians for the most part that worked for the police.
Okay.
And girls, you know, they had secretaries and stuff that did that kind of work. And
doing the record keeping and that kind of stuff.
But the guys that were, that did the interrogation, and the chief, of course, were the ones that were the main cadre of the place, and the rest were either guards or clerical help, analysts, the kitchen crew, the medical staff, and supply people.
The analysts would be special branch people, I suppose.
Well, yeah, but they'd be civilians.
Okay.
They were. Had been hired and trained by the special branch, and then retrained by us into the specific
type of
job they'd be doing
in
an interrogation program, as opposed to sitting in, in an office at special branch headquarters or something. But this special branch guy, he flew in the Way with me, and this one of these coups was going on. And we landed at Way. We were the last plane to get in, as a matter of fact, the Air American plane was flying. He was wearing civilian clothes and he had his kid with him, a girl. And I told him, I said, hey, we get into that, we pull up to a stop in this plane and these guys come out in their jeeps and they all got submachine guns and rifles and watching us get off the plane, wondering who the hell we were.
Yeah.
And I told him, because all this had happened the day when we were flying up from Da Nang, and it all happened while we were in the air.
Yeah.
And I told him, I said, before we got off, I said, look, you're my interpreter.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm telling you. Anything, if you have any rank or anything, you're a civilian, you're my interpreter.
Because if he's with the government, you could be part of it,
He's been shot, maybe, who knows?
Okay.
So, he was scared to death. You know, I knew they wouldn't do anything to me, but if they had known he was a special branch, or any government official, they'd have nailed him. They'd at least arrested him. They wouldn't have hurt him. Maybe they might have killed him.
Yeah.
So we got off and, who are you, and told him where I was. And we got there a little early, as a matter of fact, so the guy I was supposed to meet wasn't there to meet me. He hadn't gotten there yet. Who's this? I told him. My interpreter. What's his rank? I said, no rank. He said, it works for me.
Yeah.
I said, that's his kid.
Yeah.
He's just coming with me. I can't deal with the
people up here without an interpreter. They're not going to arrest an American.
They wouldn't arrest my interpreter either.
Yeah, right.
And he spoke excellent English, so.
What'd you do for an interpreter most of the time, whoever you were with?
Whoever went
you
to
didn't have a,
no, I didn't bring one with me, no.
You didn't have a guy who was permanently your translator
or
something like that?
The guy in the province had one. That's what we used. And but I didn't have, well, I didn't need one. Every time I went to a province, I was dealing with our guy there, and he had his own interpreter. But we got through this, and we got, and the guy we were supposed to meet finally showed up, and he had come up with his interpreter, and got us through the police lines, the army lines where they had.
Were you ever in one of these picks when it got attacked?
Never in a pick, no. Okay. I was always in the daytime. Yeah, okay. The daytime. They may have attacked in the daytime later as the war got worse. But, yeah, I was,
Yeah, okay. Because they always go, yeah.
No, we got, I guess a lot of them got attacked during Tet.
Okay.
During Tet Offensive. Of course, during Tet Offensive, I was in Thailand, so no way I could get attacked. But while I was there, none ever got attacked during the day. Yeah, I guess there was a couple that had had some shellings at night and were raids on them. And, but not many. Mm-hmm. I can't even remember exactly which ones, but I seem to recall that there were a couple of them that did get hit at night.
I knew it. The guy who told me he was director of the PIC program from 67 to 69, I was talking to him on the phone. He said he had a picture of a PIC. With the water tower had been hit by a mortar and tumbled over, and it sort of looked like F troop, you know, an F troop. Yeah. Where the guy jumps off the water.
Who was that? Who was that? That ended up?
This guy's name was Bob Slater. He was a Marine captain.
Slater. He ran the pick program. That a Marine? Well,
he's
got to replace me. He's not there.
Well, he's there. He didn't come there until July of '67.
Yeah, well, he got to replace me. He took over in '64, and he replaced me in Thailand. So he. He came to Thailand and replaced me in 66.
He replaced you in Vietnam in 66.
He replaced me in Vietnam in 66, and then he replaced me in Thailand in 68. but he was running the show in 66 when I left. This guy, he's dead now. He had a attack and died last year.
What was his name?
Bob Hill. But as far as I know, he ran it right up until the time he left. 60, which would have been 60. No, that's right. He was there already.
Okay.
When I left, so his tour would have been up sometime in 67.
Okay.
Because he came while I was there, and then he was the one that was finally picked to replace me after Nelson Berkman told me that the other guys that I picked were all too young. They were all older than I was, but he thought they were too young. We finally settled on Bob, and he didn't like it very much, but he took it over. He was a very capable guy. I knew he had been around a long time. But I did get a kick out of Nelson when I told him this one guy. You can't have him. He's only 29, so he's older than I am. You've got to be kidding me. He said, I swear you were 39. I said, I'm 28. Just look old. Cup like. So by the time I left, I can't remember how many, but most of them were built, and that were going to be built.
Yep.
And we did cancel a few. I thought we had decided there was a couple of problems that we just weren't going to build any of them. I mean, I went to Fuyen or whatever called Fuelva.
Yeah.
And my God, the place was so small. I mean, one interrogation center would have taken up the whole province. It was a province that had been made by taking a couple pieces of a couple of other provinces.
Okay.
And that was one that, after visiting it and going around with the guy who was responsible for that province, he didn't live there, he had another province.
Mm-hmm.
I agreed with him. I said, there's no way to build one here. And he showed me the prison they had, which was a barbed wire enclosure. It's like World War II prisoner of war camps. And that's where they kept all the criminals in B.C. and everything else. So they didn't have a jail in the town. They only had a couple of buildings in the town. So there was a few that weren't going to be built, as far as I knew. And then most of them were either built or under construction by the time I left.
Okay. Without infringing on your book rights to Lucien Conin, when did you first meet him? Did you know
in
him
Vietnam.
Well in Vietnam?
I knew him very well in Vietnam. But that's where I first met him, too.
What kind of, was it social or was it professional?
No, I didn't work with him as far as, he worked out of the embassy. He was with, he came out, he'd been there before, but he came out with the Lansdale group, and I didn't get involved with anything they did. didn't know what they were doing, didn't much care. But I used to see him in the Cosmos, and that's where we used to drink beer together, but that's all.
And then you maintained your friendship over the years and back to here?
Oh, yeah. With all the guys I've worked with in the agency. I've worked 14 years in the agency, and I don't know how many thousands of people I met. I can honestly say there was only three guys I ever met in the agency that I would either not work with again, never have worked for me, or never work for. Only three out of all the people I met. Or some I didn't, particularly get along with.
Just personality differences, or?
Some of them, these three guys were just, they were, and two of them, I wouldn't mind sitting down and drinking beer with them at all, but they just
not work with them.
Not working, I would not. One of them, because I thought he was one of the most incompetent son of bitches I ever met in my life. He was in the wrong field, he shouldn't have been in. Another one, because he was just an obnoxious son of a bitch. And the third one was even more obnoxious and just an angry, real angry guy. Nobody liked him. Well, a lot of people didn't like him. I shouldn't say nobody liked him. A lot of people did not like him. And one of them was in Thailand when I first met him. One was in Vietnam when I first met him. The guy in Vietnam, for instance, when he introduced me, himself to me and my wife and I, we were on the roof of the Rex Hotel, and we'd only been there a short time, and we were up there having drinks after work one night, and he'd seen me in the halls, and he walked up and he introduced himself to me as, he says, I saw you in the halls today, you were John Muldoon, aren't you? I said, yeah. He says, I'm the station's CICE expert. And then he told me his name, which I'm not going to tell you, but then he tells me his name after that. And I thought, this is a hell of a way to introduce yourself. Why not tell me, I am Tom Jones? And then sometime during the course of the conversation, if I wanted to know, you could tell me what your job was.
Yeah.
But that's, he just seemed really impressed with himself.
What's CICE?
Counterintelligence, counter-espionage.
Oh, okay.
But that's the way he introduced himself, and I thought, Jesus, this is an egotistical thing. Whatever. Why would he introduce himself that way instead of saying, my name is Tom Jones?
Yeah.
We work in the same office. So welcome to Saigon. We buy you a drink. And during the course of the conversation, I understand you were working the interrogation program and all. I'm like, I work in this.
Mm-hmm.
Fine. But to walk up, walk up and say, hi.
I'm president of the senior class.
Right, yes. My name is.
I'm the quarterback.
Quarterback on the football team. I'm a pitcher on the baseball team. And my name is.
And what are you? I'm the monitor chairman.
But that was one guy. Otherwise, he was an okay guy. But that turned me against him. And I thought, he was a little bit of a pompous ass. Really wasn't all that qualified either. Overblown opinion of himself. The other guy was one that just was in the wrong business. But I liked him very much. Nice guy. I liked him a lot, but I just...
Well, what's the difference between a guy who's in the paramilitary stuff? You think they just got to be a little bit...
These guys, a guy that I worked with in Korea, first met in Korea, he started out paramilitary. And ended up being the chief of station in one of our stations in Africa. You switch back and forth. A lot of these guys in Vietnam in those days, they were all CTs. They were young guys. They were as old as they were older than I am, a lot of them.
What do you mean CTs?
It's called career trainees, or JOTs, they call them, junior officer trainees. They went to a course. And they brought him in out of college, and they gave him whatever their GS rating was. And they put him through a 6 months course of training and everything. And part of it was paramilitary training.
Okay.
All right. And then they sent him over to Vietnam. They sent a whole class over there. And they all couldn't go in as intelligence officers. Some went as paramilitary, and they just happened to be lucky to draw.
So they'd send over 40 guys at a time? Or something like that?
Well, they did with this group. They sent a whole bunch. Yeah, a whole slew of them. They'd all been, there were like two classes in a row. They graduated within a couple months of each other. They shipped the whole group of them to Vietnam. Their first assignments, a lot of them. They'd never been overseas in their life, except if they'd been in the military first or something.
Yeah.
This is it. Here they were, and they were just learning. And some of them were just learning the paramilitary business, and some of them were just learning the intelligence business, but they'd gone through training.
Okay.
And they all outranked me, and they were, you know, that same age as I was, a little older, some of them, most of them. But they, you know, this was their first time. They'd been taught in the classroom and all this stuff, and through training exercises, how to do this and that and the other thing. Now they were getting their baptism of fire. I thought, like, what a hell of a place to send them for their baptism.
You mean a lot of them weren't former special forces guys?
No, they were just
out of college.
A lot of them had never been in the military. Graduated from college, were hired by the CIA. And maybe some of them joined to keep out of the military. Who knows?
They must have got the surprise of their life then.
Some of the older ones had been in the military and had been officers, you know, lieutenants or whatever, gone through ROTC and all that good stuff.
Okay.
Well, there's a whole slew of them there. And so it wasn't that they wanted to be paramilitary for the rest of their life, it's just that's where they were.
That's what they got the job.
That's what their first job overseas was, and some of them had to be. And since they all had the training, it was, you guys are going to be paramilitary, you guys are going to be this. And some of them got there, and they got there, their job was changed. You know, boom, you're not going to be this, you're going to be here.
And this is all happening in 65?
A lot of them were there, but no, it was 64, a lot of them got there before I did. But most of them got there, I think, in 64, late 63. Most of them in 64, but they got there earlier in 64 than I did. I didn't get there in November. And they were almost all there, the ones I'm talking about, before I got there.
Okay.
Later, they started bringing in older guys that had experience in other places. But a good majority of the guys up country when I got there were on their first assignments overseas.
Jesus.
And they learned fast. They were all smart, very sharp guys. Most of them.
Yeah, because they got to go through all those tests. You got to have the aptitudes and that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
So did a class arrive while you...